From the Sky News Centre at 6, the government's chief drug advisor has been forced to resign after saying ecstasy and LSD are less harmful than alcohol and tobacco. Professor David Nutt also says smoking cannabis creates only a relatively small risk of psychotic illness, and the risks of taking ecstasy are no worse than riding a horse. The Home Secretary Alan Johnson says he has no confidence in him. Professor Nutt says he can't understand all the fuss about his comments.
I don't know why, really. It's unusual political times, I suppose, elections and all that. Disappointing, but politics is politics and science is science, and there's a bit of a tension between them sometimes.
Up to 120,000 postal workers are to take part in another nationwide strike. They'll walk out a week today and again on Monday the 9th of November in their row over modernisation plans. Royal Mail has condemned the decision as destructive. Billy Hayes, the leader of the Communication Workers Union, says they're disappointed a resolution's not been reached.
As soon as this is wrapped up for CW members, the public, Royal Mail and the wider community, the better for all. So we want to get this wrapped up and we want everybody focused on an agreement. That's what we're saying to our negotiators now.
A man claiming to be one of the Somali pirates holding a British couple say they'll come to no harm as long as their families pay up, but he's warned there could be consequences if a rescue attempt is made. Pregnant women are being reassured that both of the swine flu vaccines licensed for use in the UK are safe. Updated advice from the World Health Organization says they can have either of the two jabs. BP's been hit with a record fine of $87 million after 15 people died at a Texas refinery explosion in 2005. The British oil giant has been accused of failing to address critical safety issues. And Robbie Williams has cancelled his live performance at the MTV Europe Music Awards next week. The singer's apparently double-booked himself. That's the latest. I'm Tim
Jones.
This
is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
Did you know that you can get a self-test for chlamydia? The test is free and confidential. It's as easy as peeing in a pot. If you are 15 to 24 years old, make sure you get a test every year or whenever you change sexual partner. Contact your GP, sexual health clinic, or call the Chlamydia Screening Office on 0845 180 0050.
Mam, Stuff indeed, folks. That is the unmistakable sound of Biram Sek. If you like the sound of that and you would like to hear a little bit more of it, then I recommend you get along to St. George's on Sunday for Africa Oyaya. You can hear Biram Sek along with Haleli, Mankala, Cecilia Novello, Bulawayo, Ben Badu and the Afro Celts, and Fidelis Mirembi. I can't recommend it strongly enough. I know it's not free. Tony has stepped out of the studio for a moment. This is Billy Quain with The Week in What's On. What's on this week that I recommend? And I have to say, I recommend Africa Oyaya. It's at St. George's. It does cost money, I'm afraid. I know this What's On is supposed to be What's On for free, but it's only £4.99 for 10 acts, 10 hours, and it's St. George's on Sunday. So, go along to that. It's tied in, I would like to say, with the Africa Eye Film Festival, which is at the Watershed and at Circa Media in Portland Square. If you would like further details, there is an awful lot going on this weekend at the Africa Eye Festival. Details, go on to africaeye.org.uk, because there is just too much for me to tell you about in one go on the Africa Eye stuff. So, moving onwards next, we're going to stick with cinema, and I'm telling you, I'm giving you good advance warning for this. It's the Unchosen Film Festival at St. Stephen's Church next Friday evening. This is a film festival curated by Nick Broomfield, the renowned filmmaker who makes his home in Bristol, and it's about, boundaries, borders, and the globalization of the world population and people crossing, illegal immigration. That's it. It's all about illegal immigration. There we are. I finally got the words out. Next Friday is the UK premiere of Victoria Terminus. It's a tough tragedy. It's got violence and abuse on Mumbai's street kids surviving to keep rising like a phoenix from the ashes. It's after Slumdog Millionaire shone the global spotlight on their plight. Here is the story from their own mouths. This is your stop to welcome India's trouble station. Victoria Terminus. There is a post-show talk by the director Gerhard van der Vecht, and that is next Friday, 7:30 p.m. at St. Stephen's Church. All of those Unchosen films are free, so bear that in mind, I urge you. Next one we have got for you, a free talk back up. It's part of the centenary program at the Wills Memorial Building on November the 2nd. Dr. Graham Spittle, who is the Vice President of Software UK and Ireland of IBM. He's looking for a smarter planet, technology, innovation and why it matters. He will be speaking for free at 6 p.m. on the 2nd of November. You do need to book tickets for this, even though they are free. It's an exploration of how we are all connected economically, technically and socially through systems and processes. So I would urge you to go along and have a listen to that. I'm going to move on swiftly to theatre. This week and next week in the Alma Theatre, you have got a new play by Alex Boyd called Playtime. I would urge you to go along and see these. I know they're not free. I think this one was £7 for me. It's a challenging piece of work. Meta theatre, you could argue. It's about a playwright who's in the process of creating a play. I liked it. It was a little confusing in places, but I think an awful lot of the work that's showcased up at the Alma is by young writers, and they give an awful lot of aspiring actors their first opportunities as well. So please do go along and support. Staying with theatre, at the Brewery Theatre on North Street in Bedminster, I cannot recommend strongly enough Full Twist. It's by the Pangotic Theatre Company, and I'm going to have to read the blurb to you on this one. I went to see it last night and it was staggeringly good, but it's very difficult to describe. So this is how they describe it themselves. Combining new circus and physical theatre, this playful performance from award-winning circus theatre company Pangotic is an innovative blend of masks, juggling, comedy and physical theatre with a hint of contemporary clowning. Full Twist is a witty tale of lust and love, using absurdity and poetics to create a quirky world where four flustered hearts encounter more than a few surprises. By seamless mixing genres, Bristol-based Pangotic create fresh and innovative performance, providing an exciting and original experience. Their words, not mine. I'm not quite so eloquent as that. It is fabulous. And I'm delighted to say Matt Pang, a star of the show, will be joining me tomorrow morning about 10:15 hopefully for an hour or so to discuss how he's arrived at where he is and how much fun he's having with it. Now then, I know it's Halloween this weekend, so here we go. Trinity. On Trinity Road, down just off Old Market, you can go along at 7 p.m. and join them on Sunday the 1st of November from 7 p.m. for the annual free fireworks party. Live performances from the Ambling Band and the Glitzy Bag Hags. There is food and hot cider. That is free, I repeat that, free. 7 p.m. Sunday evening at Trinity. The Cube Cinema, not free. Saturday night at 7:30 p.m. on this special night when the boundary between living and the dead dissolves and the dead walk among us, join us for some gruesome cinematic sandwich with The Exorcist as the choice filling. William Friedkin's demonic classic needs no introduction, as we are pleased to present a 35mm print screening, which is a rare occurrence these days. Preceding that will be a seldom seen Dutch shocker, and as the clock strikes 12, we end the night with Visceral Video Nasty, a shocking triple bill not for the faint-hearted. So, you have been warned, that's for the older people. However, on a much lighter note, on Sunday, 1st of November, which is All Souls Day where I come from, it's a preparation for the evening's Mexican Day of the Dead party. Join us for a fun workshop decorating papier-mâché masks and skulls with traditional colourful patterns suitable for all. Wear old clothes. Masks to take home or decorate at the Cube. There you go. And then moving into Sunday evening, they have a Mexican-style celebration of the Day of the Dead. And that's a fiver. So, sorry about that. I did say it was no money, but it is some money. However, staying with the Cube for the remainder of the week, they're showing the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus for the princely sum of £3, which actually I think is cheaper than any of the other multiplexes that you're going to get to see the Terry Gilliam movie in at the moment. I only mention that purely because one of my very favourite artists in the world, Tom Waits, makes an appearance as the devil. So that on its own makes it worth looking at. Now, Tony is waving his hands at me like a crazy person, but I am going to warn you about what's going on at the Colston Hall for free, because I appreciate I'm under time constraints for this evening. We have got a group singing workshop on Saturday the 31st of October from 10 until 12. The tickets for this are free. There are some professional musicians coming down to lend a helping hand with you to help make the most of your creative ideas in a songwriting forum. If you want further information on that, please call 9222510. That's the songwriting workshop this Saturday at the Colston Hall. On Monday at the Colston Hall, I know there's been much furore about the grant that they had recently, but I feel it's incumbent on me to advertise what they are doing for free. Monday, you have the group singing workshop. It's in the new education suite, and that is at 8 o'clock, also free. Now, I mention this because I'm quite a fan of cello music. Jessica Hayes, who's a cellist trained at the Royal Academy, and Raphael Luc, who's an accordionist, are going to be playing works by J.S. Bach, Sanson, Astor Piazzolla, and Sergei Rachmaninoff. Concessionary tickets are available for this. It's a lunchtime concert. It's a fiver, I think, and the number of the box office for this one is 922-3686, and that is at lunchtime on Tuesday. Fiver, yes, there we go. There's a free open session specialising in urban live music with youth work support, so very popular. This is a very popular event, so get there early to book a practice room. That is on at the Basement Studio at the Unicorns on Thursday from 7:30 until 10:30. Now then, there is at the Victoria Rooms limited seating available for this event. On Wednesday, a free concert. This is actually Wednesday, free concert at the Victoria Rooms. You have got Four Hands Pianoforte Music by Mozart. It's the sonata in B flat, K358, amongst others. Great stuff indeed, and it's free. That's at 1:15 at the Victoria Rooms. You do not need to book for that one. Now, finally, City Museum. You have got for the next 2 months. It starts every day at 10 and finishes at 5. A display of work by young people from Fairbridge West and Young Bristol. Local artists Motorboy, Helga Gamboa, Gray Mortimer Evelyn have been working with 12 young people to create 20 pieces inspired by the practice of subvertising, making a statement by altering the meaning of an existing image or creating a spoof. This is a technique proved very popular by the recent Banksy versus Bristol Museum exhibition. That goes on for quite a long time. Now then, on next Sunday, it starts at 10:30 to a 4 p.m. finish, I beg your pardon. There's a wide selection of second-hand books for sale, fiction, non-fiction, children's books and CDs at the City Museum and Gallery. Go along to that. And then finally, we've got Calling All Bright Sparks. Come along and learn about the science of light. How does light travel? How can you use the sun to tell the time? How did our ancestors light the dark nights? Well, there's an interesting one, actually. Find out about the craft and handling activities. Drop in between 10 and 4 p.m. this Sunday. There is no need to book, and it is most suitable for children between 2 and 11 years, but I can almost guarantee you any adults will pick up a few hints and tips as well. Now, that's it for me. I'm going to play out some music. If you like the sound of this, go along to St. George's on Thursday. This is Astillero Tango. Thank you.
Lovely bit of music there from pianist Zoe Raman. Thanks to Billy Quinn for the guide to what's on for free in Bristol, and sometimes not totally free, but mostly free. Anyway, Marina Morris is back with us again now. And Marina, you've been looking, I believe, this week at Halloween.
Yes, Tony, yes. Halloween, the pre-Christian Celtic festival of the dead, appears to have originated in Celtic Britain more than 2,000 years ago and symbolized the beginning of the Celtic New Year. The Celts believed that the year had two major parts, winter and summer, with a festival marking the change. Summer being symbolic of light and life, winter represented death. The main Celtic god was the sun, but during the winter, Samhain, Lord of the Dead, took power. On this spirit night of October 31st, the boundaries between the world of dead and world of the living having become fluid, the ghost of death returned to earth, causing trouble and damaging crops. On that day, all manner of beings were brought, ghosts, fairies and demons, all part of the dark and dread. If milk was found to be sour, evil spirits were at home, which was a bad sign for the future of the family. The Druids were Celtic priest and teacher. The color of Halloween are Celtic origins. Black was the color of winter and long night. Orange was the color of the harvest. The black cat is another symbol of Halloween, but very important for Halloween is the Irish ritual of trick and or treat and the legend of Jack O'Lantern. The custom of trick-or-treat dates back to the Middle Ages. Then poor folk would go door to door receiving food in return for prayers for the dead. It's now symbolic making a deal with dark forces not to cause mischief. Jack O'Lantern is typically a carved pumpkin, although other vegetables such as turnips have also been used. They are used to frighten and scare away evil spirits. What was the biggest danger for the Celts? They believed that evil spirit could easily do bad things for them and were afraid that they might take their body and use it for next year. How did they save themselves? The Druids offered food and animal, believing this offering would appear the spirits to stay away from their home. Food was very important to them because they faced the risk of winter starvation. They also wore special mask and costume to pretend to be a spirit and frighten away evil spirits. The Druids built a huge sacred bonfire of oak, where the people gathering to burn crops and animals, a sacrifice to Samhain, Lord of the Dead. There is even some more debate that human sacrifice might have been commonplace. In the 19th century, Halloween spread from the UK to America and afterwards to other countries around the world. In 2007, the Council of San Francisco banned the celebration because the previous year, 9 people were shot during the celebration. This holiday is not popular in France. Many churches, including Russian churches, recommend not celebrate this event, citing links with devil worship and evil. Other churches within the UK are recommending practicing the event with a kind mask and special rules for children's behavior. The time between Halloween and Bonfire Night is often known in the UK as Mischief Week. Then traditionally there is a rise of 16% in recorded criminal damage offenses. Avon and Somerset Police, in conjunction with trading standards, have been making checks to ensure that fireworks are not being sold to children. Shops in and around Bristol have also agreed not to sell eggs and flour to children during this period. This is what the people of Bristol think about Halloween.
And Marina, you've been out and about, haven't you, this week, talking to people on the streets of Bristol.
Yes.
So let's hear what they have to say about Halloween, and a little bit also you talk, I think, about Guy Fawkes Night and fireworks.
Will you celebrate Halloween, and is it a part of your family traditions?
No, I did when my children were younger, but I don't think I will be this year, no. Not really, no. It was a family tradition when I was older, but not when I was younger. It was bonfire night we had then, November the 5th, bonfire night.
Yeah, definitely a fan. Going out this Saturday, definitely. Going to get dressed up. We're going to a club and it's Halloween themed and we're going to get really dressed up, and I think the atmosphere is better on Halloween. Everyone's more happier, even though the original idea of it isn't too nice. So yeah, just kind of teenage fun, really. Something to do on a day.
No, not at all. No, I shouldn't think so, no.
Yeah, we like Halloween.
So celebrate it.
Yeah, I do, yeah.
People's houses.
People's houses and just go out.
And party.
Yeah, and dress up.
Yeah.
We all support the fish.
My family strongly supported. We have parties regularly.
We have parties every year to support Halloween.
And my dad dresses up as a giant pumpkin.
Actually, never. I have been in a Halloween party because in my country it's not really a big celebration. This is my first Halloween. I came from Hungary. Yes, I think yes, for sure. Friday and Saturday as well. I'm looking for some nice Halloween parties, some events. I'm going out with my friends. Yeah.
No. Yes. Well, I don't personally know. No, I won't be celebrating. I'm having a party. We've got to have some kids in the early evening, and then when they've gone to bed, we're going to have an adult party. Recently, yes, the past 2 years.
Is it innocent for children to threaten bad behavior? And should parents be responsible for the actions of their children?
Just fun, but parents should keep an eye on their children, yes.
For trick-or-treating? I suppose, yeah, because the fireworks are being sold, and I don't think trick-or-treating is very safe in a big city for little kids to be walking around and knocking on doors and asking, because you know, not everyone's nice. As much as you want them to be, but if the age limit went up for fireworks, it would be fine. I mean, fireworks are cool as long as you're responsible. A child from a good race family wouldn't throw a firework at a stranger, but yet it's the shop's fault for selling it to youngsters as well. So it's many factors concern.
I think it's quite dangerous, really. I think children sometimes take it a bit out of hand with the egg throwing and things like that, and knocking on some people's doors, you know, older people, and it frightens them, really. I would say definitely, yes. I think they can talk to their children, and if they are going to go out, then they should be with, you know, a grown-up. But I don't really agree with the whole Halloween anyway, so...
I think to a certain extent it's harmless fun, but the idea of sort of children banging on doorsteps for things which people are obliged to provide them with, I think that's taken too far. But there is a point at which it is still harmless fun for kids, really. I suppose it depends on the age of the children. When it gets to the point where the child is sort of aware of what they're doing, then obviously the child is largely responsible for their own actions. But I think obviously when they're young children, the parents should be responsible. Yeah,
it's just a bit of fun to it once a year. Yeah,
the adrenaline of it's amazing.
I don't think so. This is just fun. Maybe it can be worse as well. But yeah, it's strange. I cannot really decide. Yeah, maybe it's fun. No, they have to take the responsibility. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's a difficult one. Ultimately, yes, of course, parents are responsible up to a point. But, of course, they can't be around them 24/7. So, you know, you have to give the children a certain amount of leeway. And hopefully they will respond in a positive manner.
Just fun, yes. You know, just be polite, to respect what people say. People say no, you walk away. You know, just general basic manners.
Do you know the origins of Halloween? And do we need to educate children about this?
Yes, it's a Celtic fire festival, which divided the old and new year. I think so, yes. I think you should educate children about most things. Everything, in fact.
I think it's the same sort of scenario as of Christmas. We all know that it's all made up. It's a bit of fun, as long as people don't take it too seriously. I don't know the origins, no. It's American.
That's what I know.
I think it comes from like a pagan festival or something. I'm not exactly sure, but yeah.
Yeah, basically you need to tell them exactly where and how and the origin of this Halloween, the implications, you know, concerning the Halloween, you know. You have to let them know, so they actually have to choose within themselves, and parents have to do a role like guiding them, telling them the implications of it, you know, so they have a choice to go about it.
I don't think so. We have to educate them about the origins. No, no.
Just celebrate.
Just celebrate, yeah, and enjoy.
That was your response to Marina Morris out on the streets of Bristol asking questions about Halloween, whether you're going to be celebrating it. But we've also this week been having a chat to the Church of England in Bristol, specifically the Bristol Diocese, and even more specifically, a chap who was until recently the parish vicar of St Paul's. That's Paul Bartle Jenkins. So I spoke to Paul a couple of days ago about this, and I first started off by asking him about what he felt the actual origins of this were and how it fitted in with the Church of England and the Church's feast days.
Father Paul, I'm from Wales. I've been priest in charge of St. Paul's. And Tony, you're asking me about the origins of Halloween, and they've got two kind of distinct roots. One is the Christian one, which is connected with All Hallows Eve, the evening before All Hallows Day, when we remember the saints, and then the next day we remember all the souls, the ones we've known and loved who've gone before us.
So is that the one day All Saints Day and the next day All Souls Day?
That's correct. November the 1st is All Saints, November the 2nd is All Souls. Now against that you've got the lovely old roots pagan background of the ending of the summer, the beginning of the winter, and the time when the seasons are changing, and all the lovely old historical traditions that are culturally enshrined to do with that.
So isn't there something a bit negative about the second one, in that it's seeing the life flourishing slowly, sort of conking out and dying for the winter?
Not necessarily. It's like the winter solstice, when people thought, you know, the sun was dying in old times and needed bonfires and celebrations and bringing evergreen things into your house, and like holly and laurel and things like that, and trying to compensate for the light's absence by bringing in candles and lights and bonfires and everything else like that, which is what most people are doing these days, Christians and even Sikhs, with having, you know, Christmas trees and everything else brought into their home to celebrate Christmas.
So how is All Saints and All Souls actually celebrated in the Christian Church?
All Saints, we commemorate the saints, we venerate them, and people like me would challenge ordinary people in the pews, if you like, to actually consider that they too are saints, potentially or actually, and that's the message. It's not them and us, but them working with us and we working with them and trying to move towards holiness.
So, yeah, so what exactly is a saint?
Well, the official ones, of course, designated by the Holy Roman Catholic Church, like take Mother Teresa at the moment, who, God rest her soul, has been, I understand, beatified and recognized as holy, and not yet moved towards canonization to be regarded as a saint. But the same church does, in fact, knock off saints, and I think we have some saints who probably never, ever existed. St. George, for example? I'm not sure.
Okay, and what about All Souls Day? How's that celebrated?
It's celebrated by people remembering those who've gone before us. And in different countries, it's done in different ways. In the Caribbean and Central America, Mexico, for example, they celebrate death. And they have skulls and skull sweeties and things like that. They decorate graves. They put lights and candles and things on it. In our church here in Bristol, we simply read out the names of people who've died and who are remembered by people who are left and love them.
So is this a way, do you think, that maybe that the Christian church in the early days was taking up the pagan holidays and maybe Christianizing them?
Well, I already mentioned Christmas, didn't I? And, of course, the evidence seems to suggest that Jesus was not born on Christmas Day, the 25th of November, but probably with the alignment of the major planets, sometime probably in September, possibly the 12th year undecided. And the Christian church decided to superimpose the nativity of our Lord and the celebration of it at that winter solstice, but really rather a little bit later, when the light of the world was coming and the days were getting longer.
So if you're saying that Jesus wasn't actually born on Christmas Day, aren't you a heretic?
I don't think so, Tony. Come on, where'd you get that from? I think that's an established theological belief throughout the Christian Church.
Yeah.
Okay. To what extent, then, do you think these celebrations are actually a continuation of the old religion?
They're both. They're both that. The old pagan and the Christian superimposition upon paganism, and also commercial interests, particularly the growth of, in America, of trick and treat that spread back to England. It's a kind of natural revenge, I suppose. I think that the trick or treat thing moved from the Irish potato famine, when a lot of Irish people went over to America, taking their traditions with them, that actually included Halloween and All Hallows Eve, and, you know, the bobbing for apples and things like that. My background is that I'm Welsh. You can possibly tell that from my voice. And I remember as a child, well, I'm up now 65, 66 coming up, of the celebration that we had for Halloween. And it was in Welsh, something like Nos Calangis. And we bobbed for apples in a bowl of water. It was very uncomfortable, we nearly drowned. And then we used to bite apples, so hanging on strings and things like that. And that was a fun celebration, and that was very much a Celtic rejoicing, perhaps in even autumn and the fruit and things that came. But it certainly was nothing to do by carving nasty faces on pumpkins, which we didn't have in those days, or trying to carve them into turnips and things. It was a bit like the Roman god Janus, from which we get January, both looking back and looking forward. And I just hope that people look forward in hope.
And what do you think about this thing that we see nowadays, where it's almost every supermarket and every, well, Woolworths isn't around anymore, places like that, have all got these little stands in for youngsters to buy the Halloween costumes? It is kind of glitzy. Do you think it's actually a positive thing overall, having this kind of view of Halloween?
As the Jamaicans say, I think it'd make me sick. I don't think it's a good idea at all. It's obviously commercial exploitation. And actually, it does do some damage, because as someone involved in the Ministry of Deliverance, which is the new term for exorcist, I've discovered over the years that there are an increasing number of people who've lost their peace and are coming for help, for house blessing or for counselling or whatever, and it occurs at this time. Whether it's connected with the actual season and letting the summer go and fearing the winter, or whether it is, and I suspect it is, it's fueled by all the pumpkins and the demons and the witches and all that stuff. So it's caused by a number of things.
If someone is worried about this sort of thing, you're saying this is going on at this time of year, what can they do about it?
Well, hopefully communicate with other people and share their distress and come to people who can perhaps help them to sort out what is going on in their lives that has made them so frightened or concerned or whatever.
So how can the church actually help?
Well, the church does help with its process of ministry of deliverance and speaking to people and prayer, but primarily investigating what has gone on in that person's life that's made them so vulnerable to being spooked by witches and all that other kind of paraphernalia that commercially is associated with Halloween.
That was Paul Bartle Jenkins there I was talking to earlier this week. He was, until recently, the parish vicar of St. Paul's. Well, staying on the Halloween theme, what if some of the terror attacks we hear about in the news every week were actually being planned and orchestrated by our own side? This is the concept of the false flag. Now, Martin, what was the origin of this expression of false flag?
It's a naval warfare term from the 18th century, when sailing ships used to fight each other on the high seas. One common trick was to run up the flag of your enemy. Say you were a British ship, Cochrane that was famous for doing this. It was a famous sea dog, British sea dog. He would run up, for example, a Spanish flag, sail towards the Spanish fleet. They would think he was a Spanish ship, and then when he got close enough, he'd run up the British flag and open fire.
Swap flags at the last minute.
So that's the whole idea of a false flag. So that people, basically, the idea is that you do something and then get somebody else blamed for it.
So the idea was, you know, that you actually get very, very close to the enemy by pretending to be on their own, on their side.
It's a form of deception. So when we talk about false flag terrorism, what we're talking about is a terrorist attack, which you carry out, whoever you are, but then you blame it on somebody else and say, oh yes, those bad people over there, they did this.
Okay, now a week ago, CIA-funded Islamic group Jundullah killed some of Iran's top military brass, including a Revolutionary Guard general. We ask, who's really planting these bombs, and to what extent are the Islamic extremists manipulated by Western intelligence agencies? We look at the CIA's record in Latin America in a minute and elsewhere. US historian Webster Tarpley rose to prominence after the publication of his book in the 1990s entitled The Unauthorized Biography of George H.W. Bush, that is, Bush Sr., who was president, the US president in the mid-1990s before Bill Clinton. Although Webster Tarpley rarely appears on mainstream television and radio, indeed the Barry Taylor, who helps run Bristol University, banned him from booking a lecture hall in 2007, saying only that Tarpley could bring the university into disrepute. Tarpley believes, as do many others, that the many so-called terror groups may actually be well-known to the Western intelligence services, so well-known, in fact, that they can do very little without Western support. Tarpley begins by introducing the sinking of the USS Maine on February 15, 1898, which started a new phase in the American-Spanish War. Then, the famous Gulf of Tonkin incident on the 4th of August 1964, where a US Navy ship was supposedly attacked. But it turned out later there was no attack at all. That declaration of war that came from that Gulf of Tonkin incident led to 60,000 American soldiers dying and between 2 to 3 million deaths of Vietnamese. Anyway, here's Webster Tarpley explaining his idea, at least his take, on what is false flag terrorism.
Now, here in the United States, we're dealing with this secret government. When did the secret government start? Hard to say. Probably sometime after the Civil War, probably sometime, certainly before you had the battleship Maine blown up in Havana Harbor. The most recent study by Admiral Rickover, famous admiral, found that the explosion came from inside the boat. So an inside job, not done by the Spanish who were controlling Havana Harbor. But here we have the Hearst Press, okay? Here's the Maine. Here's an underwater mine. And here we have algunos bin Ladenitos, los bin Ladenitos Españoles, with their periscope, and they're about to blow it up. And it says, this picture fixes the responsibility to the satisfaction of the American people. So take heart, right? Those fascist parrots you hear on the radio every afternoon, and O'Reilly and Hannity and all the fascist parrots, they're not new. That's just the Hearst Press on the air with their usual jingoistic yellow garbage. Next. And remember, McKinley was not interested in going to war, really, but he was forced to by the furor created in the Congress. In other words, you stampede the Congress and you get what you want. So that's nothing new. There's also a tradition, it's more recent. I don't know if you noticed this, but for people my age, this should have been a kind of an earth-shaking event. In, I believe it was September of 05, the National Security Agency, in the news these days, has conceded that most of the allegations of the Gulf of Tonkin incident of August 1964 were false. But they were not ordered by Lyndon B. Johnson or Dean Rusk or McNamara, no, no. Those were middle-level employees covering up, CYA, and that's what it was. Now, too bad for the 60,000 people who died in that war from this side. Too bad for the 2 to 3 million on the other side. Too bad for Cambodia destroyed and left in prey to a fascist dictatorship. It was a fake. So get used to the idea that they lie and they fake, and not only in the previous century, but also quite recently in your lifetime, enough to have impacted you or most people here in the room. Now, let's begin to talk a little bit about the impossibilities of the official version. And I want to take this opportunity to come up with some news in terms of Abel Danger. One of the problems with this is you have these 19 people, and nobody knows where they come from. There's no proof that they had any connection to anything. Some of them are from Saudi Arabia, but some of them are not, right? Atta's from Egypt, apparently, if he exists. We're in a realm of pure myth. And there's also the tremendous problem of whether these people could ever, like Atta or Jara over here, or Hani Hanjour, probably the most inept, could they have ever piloted these planes, right? And it seems to me the answer is no. Well, the 9/11 Commission report, right, the Governor Kane and Lee Hamilton and so forth from July of 05 says, well, those are the people who did it. Now, we have to pause for a second. If you believe the official version, and I say this to everybody, if you believe the official version, what you're saying is that Bush was a liar. Most people, I think, would agree with this. Bush was a liar up until September 11th. And then, strangely, for a couple of months, he told the truth. And then he went back to being a liar again. Right? So here's the whole government, through the voice of David Kaye, saying, when it comes to Iraq, we were all wrong. Well, we lied. You weren't wrong. You lied. So can you believe, can anybody believe, and this is where you got to get to the gatekeepers. If you profess the official version, you are saying Bush lied in the campaign, everybody knows, but then after 9/11 he told the truth, and then he went back to lying. No. He lied before, during, and after. Now, my method essentially regards terrorist events as composites. They're a point of intersection of three or four different levels of reality. And the main thing you have to understand is you've got certainly the people you see, right, the ones we've just showed you, Atta and company. Those are the dupes, the useful idiots, the fanatics, but above all, the double agents who run them. Those are the scapegoats who are going to take the fall. The problem you always have to apply is, does the patsy have the physical technical ability to create the effects observed? Can Lee Harvey Oswald, using the Mannlicher Carcano 1917 rifle, successfully fire the requisite number of shots with bolt action in the time that he has? No. And it doesn't depend on his criminal intent. He can have all the criminal intent in the world. It won't let him do it. And these guys, you can say, oh, they hate us. Oh, they hate us. Doesn't matter how much they hate you. They can't do it. Okay, so this is a whole world of provocateurs, double agents. This is sort of the wormy underside of FBI, CIA, NSA, the rest of them. You've also got to look for moles, government officials loyal to a private network. This is important. They don't follow the chain of command, even. They're not certainly not loyal to a constitution, but they're rather loyal to a clique. It's ultimately in Wall Street, but it's also senior government officials, generals, and people like this. Those are the moles. They also have to organize the cover-up. The moles have to make sure that nobody interferes with the patsies before the fact. Not because the patsies are going to carry out the attack, but because if the patsies are already in jail, you can't blame the crime on the patsies. So they've got to stay free, and then they've got to be arrested immediately, huh? And you've then got to have a cover-up. And then you have professional killers. There's got to be a role in this for, I believe, a privatized command center. There's got to be a role for assassins, in other words, people like the people who really killed Kennedy, coming into town, getting out of town. Patsies love attention. They love to get on TV. Again, Oswald gets on TV, gets on the radio, gets noticed. Atta, same thing, right? Always fighting with people, abrasive. Then the professional killers, who don't say anything. They come in, shoot, leave. They're not ideologues in the same sense. They're not interested in popping off in public. Before we leave, just a privatized command center. Again, outside, I believe, not certainly not Dick Cheney. Can you imagine you're going to have this whole operation, you're going to make it depend on a guy who's 4 heart attacks and 3 pacemakers, sitting there with his wife who keeps turning the CNN up so you can't hear the interagency task force talking? And the whole thing doesn't work without the brainwashed world of the controlled corporate media. Okay? And that's state-sponsored false flag terrorism, because the thing says we're Al-Qaeda, and they're not Al-Qaeda, they're a branch of CIA and MI6.
Well, that's a pretty outlandish way of looking at some of these terrorist attacks, Martin. But do you think there's that was Webster Tarpley there, by the way, speaking in New York a couple of years ago. Do you think there's actually any truth to what he's saying about moles and patsies?
Yes, I mean, I think that it was a slightly confused clip because it covered a lot of ground. But the fundamental conception that he has of the moles, the patsies, and the technicians is a useful way to think about these things.
So, what is a mole?
A mole will be basically those who are the ultimate perpetrators of false flag terrorist acts embedded within the state apparatus, whether it's in the United States or in Russia or anywhere else. Yeah, we're not just talking about Western intelligence services here, we're talking about the way the world works. So we were talking earlier about the bombings in Moscow. That wasn't the Western intelligence services, that was the Russian intelligence services, if the allegations about it are correct.
Okay, and what about a patsy? Because we all heard, many people will know, that Lee Harvey Oswald... Lee Harvey Oswald actually said, didn't he, at a news conference in Dallas, that I'm the patsy.
Yes, that's where that comes from. So what if you've got somebody embedded in the state apparatus who wants to carry out a false flag terrorist attack, they need somebody to be seen to take the blame. So there is Lee Harvey Oswald, Osama bin Laden, the Chechens in the Russian case. They're the ones who are going to be blamed for what's happening. And then you've got the moles who are the ultimate perpetrators, and the technicians are those who actually carry out the attacks, who actually do the bombings, the shootings, whatever.
But surely, I mean, if these kind of operations were going on today, that people would be blowing the whistle about them, well, we'd at least hear some kind of... someone would be coming out on Newsnight or whatever.
Anybody can check this if they just put it into a search engine. You can check the name of General Leonid Ivashov. General Leonid Ivashov was in charge of the Russian armed forces on September the 11th, 2001. That's to say, he was chief of staff. He's retired now, but he's absolutely clear. He's saying, as far as I know, on the basis of the intelligence that I saw on the day and subsequently, this was a false flag terrorist attack by the US security forces on their own people. Now, he might be wrong about that, he might be right, but the fact is that the former head of the Russian armed forces has quite clearly said, as far as he's concerned, 9/11 was a false flag terrorist attack.
Well, that's all very well coming from the Russian camp, but are there any whistleblowers within the US, Israeli, or British camp?
Sybil Edmonds, who's an ex-FBI agent, you can again Google her, Edmonds, Sybil, S-I-B-I-L, Edmonds as in Edmonds. She's a former FBI translator, and she's saying that Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda were working hand-in-glove with the CIA right up to September the 11th.
So what is the connection between Al-Qaeda and the CIA?
Well, the CIA set Al-Qaeda up in the 1980s to channel various patsies to fight the Russians in Afghanistan. As Robin Cook said when he was Foreign Secretary, Al-Qaeda means the database, and that database was held in Amman in Jordan, and it had a whole list of people on it, people from all over the Middle East, from Algeria, from Palestine, from elsewhere, who were recruited by the Western intelligence services and funneled into Pakistan and then into Afghanistan to fight the Russians. The Al-Qaeda was created by our own intelligence services. I mean, that's not even in dispute. Everybody knows that.
Well, we'll be continuing this theme next week as well, having a filmmaker, Alan Frankovich, who's made several films about some of the more seamy underbelly of the CIA and other Western intelligence services, some of the dodgy things they get up to. But finally now, we're going to have another listen to Webster Tarpley, who does actually have his own Washington, D.C.-based weekly internet radio show called World Crisis Radio, which goes out on something called the Republic Broadcasting Network on the internet. And here he is this week talking about the Afghan elections and recent events in that whole region of the world.
So now there's going to be a runoff. The runoff is going to be held on November 7th, which in Afghanistan is already the middle of winter with all kinds of snow. Remember, 38% of the voters in Afghanistan took part on the first round, and that will be even lower on the second round. It will be a Karzai victory. There's no way that Abdullah can prevail in this, but there it is. Pakistan is in civil war at this point. There's an offensive by 30,000 troops in Waziristan. There have been attacks on the Pakistani army headquarters in Rawalpindi 2 weeks ago, assassinations of senior Pakistani officers, suicide bombs, and all the rest. So the strategy, once again, is use the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan to drive the Taliban. Of course, Taliban means what? Means a congeries, a completely heterogeneous collection of warlords, drug runners, rebels, fanatics, adventurers, freebooters, pirates, highwaymen, you name it. They're being driven into Pakistan for the purpose of fomenting civil war. In the middle of this, we have the terror attack on the Iranian Pasdaran Revolutionary Guards in the Balochistan province of southeast Iran. This is Jundullah. And as I had occasion to remark on Russia Today this past week, look at the Russia Today website. This is coming directly from the CIA. London Daily Telegraph, 25 February 2007. We're told that a high-ranking ex-CIA official says, it's not a big secret that funding for separatists like Jundullah comes directly from the CIA classified budget. And we have one guy on the record, Fred Burton, former U.S. State Department counterterrorist official. These attacks, earlier attacks by Jundullah, fall in line with U.S. efforts to supply and train Iran's ethnic minorities to destabilize the regime. So it's not just the top-down CIA coup faction of Mousavi and Rafsanjani, not just the death to Russia, death to China faction of rich elitists from North Tehran and desperate housewives from that same place. Not just the Green Revolution, the attempted people power coup. There's also the ethnic separatism card. This includes Kurds. It includes Azeris. It includes Turkmen. It includes Baluchis. And again, Arabistan, the Arab minority of Iran along the coast of the Gulf, the Persian or Arabian Gulf, as you prefer. That's the oil area. That's the Abadan oil refinery, the Karg Island tanker terminal. That's where we have the BP Liberation Front, British Petroleum Liberation Front, because if you detach them, that's who's going to own that oil. That would leave an landlocked, no-oil Iranistan for the Persians in the middle. That's the goal. A couple of more words about this in a
So, Martin, there was a little clip from Webster Tarpley's show this week. What are your thoughts about that, what he was saying, particularly at the end there, that the idea that the West may try and seize the oil reserves around the edges of Iran and leave the Iranian government and people in the middle still?
Well, I mean, clearly, Western intelligence services are sticking their finger in Iran. Whether they're right to do so in their own lights is another question. But basically, I mean, the goal is to control oil resources across the globe, and Iran is not playing ball with the program as seen from Washington and London and from Tel Aviv. And so they're in the firing line.
So also, what about Pakistan? Because it does seem that that is a failed state. To what extent is it failing accidentally, or is it being made to fail?
Well, it's the Pakistani military governments were supported during the 1980s as our glorious allies in the fight against Soviet communism. Now, of course, Pakistan is getting the blowback from our occupation of Afghanistan. Many Pakistanis, when asked who is the major threat to the security of the state, name the United States as the first threat, followed by India. So public opinion in Pakistan today sees the United States as more of a threat to Pakistan than India. And that's not really coming across in our media, how very, very suspicious Pakistani people are of all political persuasions, of the motives and the attitudes of the United States and Britain.
Very wise of them, if you ask me. Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next, Sky News at 7 o'clock. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week here on BCFM 93.2, where we review the week's news and discuss some of the big stories in Bristol, Britain and around the world. If you want a story discussed, have questions about this evening's programme or would like to suggest a topic or guest for a future show, please email me at tony@bcfm.org. bristolcitycouncil.uk. Thanks very much to this week's guest, Richard Eddy, who was the Conservative Group leader on Bristol City Council, and our resident Old Labour pundit and Oxford economist, Martin Summers. The Halloween report and Vox Pops was courtesy of Marina Morris. Next week, we have Conservative Councillor for Henbury, Mark Weston, in the studio to help us sift through the week's news. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.